All right, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Esther. We left off in chapter 4, and for those of you who weren't here last week when we went through the first three chapters, just brief background, just to kind of catch you up to speed here. The book of Esther, it's a very unique book. It's a very unusual book in many respects. It's kind of like the book of Solomon or the Song of Solomon. There's not one mention of the word God, or God's not mentioned through this book. And yet it has been decided by the early church, as well as the Jews had decided long before Christ came on the scene, that this book was part of their canon, because they could see God's hand or his providence in taking care of his people. Nobody knows for sure who wrote this book. Some people believe it may have been Ezra, which we're going to be getting into next on the next book we get into. But the overall theme here is it deals with this this king, and in some Bibles he's referred to as Ahasuerus, and most Bibles he's referred to as Xerxes. I mean, secular history bears out that this was King Xerxes, and Ahasuerus was kind of a title that was used almost like king or pharaoh or emperor or Caesar, something like of that nature. So, you know, if your Bible says Ahasuerus, or some Bibles say Xerxes, it's the same person. He was the one that was a head of 127 provinces that stretched from the tip of Africa or Ethiopia all the way to the tip of Egypt. And he was quite a powerful man. He was quite a heartless man in many respects. He was kind of a cruel man, but just had a hot temper. History bears this out pretty well. And he ruled from something like somewhere around from 485 B.C. to 465 B.C. He had about a 20-year rule before he ended up being assassinated. But in the meantime, long story short, he threw this big drunken bash for his colleagues. And after 7 days of drinking and carrying on, and he decided he was going to show off his wife Vashti to all of his buddies. And anyway, he told her to come on out and, you know, strut her stuff in front of all these guys, and she wasn't about to do it. And then he got enraged, and so his counselor said, well, why don't you just sign into law an edict where she will never be able to see the king's face again. And so he did this, and then come to find out, he kind of missed her. But they said, well, what we need to do is find yourself another queen. So he went through all the different provinces, found the most beautiful women, the most gorgeous women in the kingdom, brought them into his harem, and then he was going to choose which one he wanted to be his queen. Anyway, he fell in love with this Esther, who happened to be a Jew. But her uncle, Mordecai, is the one who raised her, and her uncle told her, whatever you do, don't tell anybody that you are a Jew. Because there was a great deal of prejudice going on in Persia, and there always has been a great deal of prejudice against the Jews. So then, just before we were closing last week, we got into a reading about another character named Haman. And Haman was an Amalekite. It appears that he was Amalekite. They were traditional rivals, or there was just a lot of bad blood between the Israelites and the Amalekites. And I don't know for sure if he was an Amalekite. He's referred to as an Agite. In other words, King Agite was the one who was, you know, slain by not Saul but Samuel. But you know, if you go back in the first book of Samuel and read about that incident there. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling here, but I just want to kind of give you an overview of who this Haman is. And he was a person who just hated the Jews, because Mordecai was Esther's cousin. He took care of her, but he was kind of a judge at the gate. You know, he was kind of an official in the province of Susa, which was the capital of the Medes and the Persians. And Haman just despised this Mordecai, and when he found out he was a Jew, Haman decided he was going to kill all the Jews. So he went to the king and was able to finagle a decree to have all the Jews slaughtered on a particular day. And what he did is he went to the astrologers, or to the people who were dealing with the occult and the witchcraft and whatnot, these diviners, these fortune tellers, and they cast lots. And the lot was referred to as Pur, P-U-R. So they cast a lot to find out what would be the best month and what would be the best day of the year to destroy all the Jews. And they came up with the 13th day of the month of Adar, which I think it's February, March in the Jewish calendar. Anyway, this is where this story picks up, is when he made that decree. So pick up in this chapter 4. And it says here, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. And he went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in each and every province there, where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay on the sackcloth and ashes. Like I said, when the Jews had heard of this decree that they were going to be all slaughtered and their property confiscated, on the 13th of Adar, which when this decree was sent out, it was going to be a whole year before the 13th of Adar rolled around. Okay, so then when the people got the news, everybody was just distressed and distraught, and you know, Mordecai himself put on sackcloth and ashes, and people were wailing and weeping because they just saw that this was going to be the end of them. And it's been estimated at this particular time in the 127 provinces that Xerxes was overseeing or ruler of, that there could have been as many as 15 million Jews. So this Haman, if you look through Jewish history, you will see just one nation after another, after another, after another, or one individual, or one king, or one dictator after another who have tried to stamp out the Jews. It's just been almost from their inception that these people have been hated. And I've said this before, and you've got to keep it in mind that, hey, you know, the reason the Jews are so despised and so hated is because there's a demonic spirit, a demonic force behind it. All right. The Bible says in Ephesians 6, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places, and all of these principalities and these demonic spirits. And the devil is just absolutely just loathes the Jews. He hates the Jews because it was through the Jews that we have received our Ten Commandments. We have received God's laws, so that God has communicated with man, that it was through the line of the Jews that Jesus Christ was born and that salvation came into the world. So, I mean, the devil, he hates everybody, but it's the Jews in particular. He hates them and he wants to destroy them, and he's been trying to destroy them since their beginning, since their inception. And look at what happened in World War II under Hitler. Hitler was a type of Haman. All right, Hitler was determined he was going to wipe out every Jew in Europe. And I don't know how many millions were there at the time, but he managed to murder 6 million of them. He got a good start on it, and Haman, he was out to murder every one of them too, men, women, and children. All right, but here's the thing. It's like, here's where you see the providence of God. You see the hand of God. I read this a long time ago, so I don't know the context of what it was, but I think there was someone, a king, who had asked some theologian if he could sum up in a very, very convincing way that there is a God and the Bible is truly his word. And the theologian said to the king, he says, I can just say it in one word, Jew. He said, it's the Jews. All you have to do is look at the Jew, and it's a modern-day miracle if you look at the Jews, because by all the laws of men and nation, the Jews should not be in existence today. You go back in their history, and you will see one nation after another, after another, after another, after another, that was more powerful, more populous. These other nations that have gone up against the Jews, there was no way the Jews could possibly survive the enemies that they encountered in the past. I don't care whether it was the Babylonians or the Philistines or the Hittites or the Jebusites or the, you know, all the way down the line. And look what happened to them in World War II. Look what happened to them in Nazi Germany. And look what happened to them in the Soviet Union. You name it. They've been all over the world, and they've been persecuted. They've been hated. And you know, before I became a Christian, I used to wonder a great deal, why is a Jew so despised? I could never figure it out. I never could put two and two together until I became a Christian, started reading the Bible, and started seeing from a spiritual perspective why they are held in such contempt. That's why when you're reading this, here is an example of another man, Haman. You might as well substitute his name for Hitler, because he had the same disposition towards God's people. But little did he know, or Hitler know, that they were being driven by demonic forces. And so when the people get this word that now they are going to be destroyed. So anyway, he said this. Well, let's back up to verse 3. In each and every province there was a command and a decree of the king came. There was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. And Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and she ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in the front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. So he gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and order her to go into the king to implore his favor, to plead with him for her people. Before we go any further, just a brief comment about what happened there. Is Mordecai's going around in sackcloth and ashes, and he can only go so far. He can't go up to the king's gate because that was forbidden. It's almost like if you can kind of envision the White House with the gate around it. I mean, you know, nobody was allowed inside the premises with sackcloth and ashes, but you could stand outside the gate. So anyway, Esther is, and she's in the palace there, and she sees her uncle out there in sackcloth and ashes, and she says, "What's with him and all those grubby clothes?" So she tells one of her assistants, "Hey, take these nice clothes down to him. Tell him to put on some nice clothes." I mean, she couldn't figure out what was going on with him. So her servant goes down there to give Mordecai these clothes, and he refused to put them on. And so then she sends back her servant to find out, well, what is the problem? And then, of course, he tells her what the problem is, and he told her what the decree was, and he even gave her a copy of the decree and told her how much that they were going to be basically sold, their lives were going to be sold, because if you remember, Haman had promised something like 20,000. What he promised was, in today's equivalent, would be something like $20 million for the exchange of the life of the Jews. He told the king that he would put that in the treasury if they annihilate these people. And I guess he figured he could get the money from confiscating a great deal of the property of these people and then giving it to the king or putting it into the king's treasury. And so Mordecai sends this message back to the queen. But just in passing, you look at this, and I think there's an application you could draw out of this too. It's like we kind of see, in a sense, here's Mordecai dressed in sackcloth and ashes, and then Esther is sending him a new set of clothes. Like, that's going to solve the problem. Of course, she didn't realize what the problem was, but I can't help but see it in a spiritual perspective, where so many times today, people, they are, in God's eyes, walking around in filthy rags, because that's their own righteousness, and they're not right before God, and they're under the sentence of death. They're under a sentence of condemnation, all right? And we kind of think that, well, what we need to do, I mean, people kind of have this misconception that all I have to do is kind of turn over a new leaf or make a new resolution or change a few things in their life, and then they're going to be acceptable to God or these are good people or whatever the situation might be. But they don't realize what the real problem is. I mean, if you take Porky the Pig and you put a tuxedo on him, I guarantee you it ain't going to change him one bit. You know, you really need to change his nature. This is the same thing with us, all right? A new set of clothes is not going to do it for us. What we really need is a new life. We need to become a new creation. Otherwise, we're going to be under the sentence of death and then suffer the consequences of that. Anyway, picking up in verse 8, he says, "And he also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for the destruction, that he might show to Esther and inform her and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor to plead with him for her people. And Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther, and Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai, 'All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And they related the words to Mordecai. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. So as the story begins to develop and unfold, like, we begin to see what's happening here is that, okay, Mordecai is basically sending a message to her saying, look, you're our only hope. You're the queen. Go talk to the king. Get him to rescind this decree. Get him to change his mind. Get him to turn things around. And then Esther sends back the message to this Hattach, and she's saying, hey, there's a law. The law of the Medes and Persians just simply said that nobody can go into the presence of the king unless they are appointed to. All right? They just can't go diddy-bopping into his throne room. Otherwise, it's under the penalty of death. And she says that if I do that, I'm going to die. Well, Mordecai says, hey, look, God has probably put you in that position for this very specific purpose. And if you don't do something, well, God will find another way to deliver us. But, you know, you really need to respond, or you're in a position, and God has put you in this position to do something for your people. So then she just figured, okay, what I'll do is I'll have everybody fast. And they didn't say pray here, but obviously that's implied. That the Jews in that capital are going to fast and pray for 3 days and before she goes into the king. And, you know, if you look at this, I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. All right. You look at Esther. Esther, you know, she must have really, really been beautiful. I mean, you know, of all the women in this whole province, 127 provinces, and she, out of all of them, excelled far beyond the rest of them. Well, she had a lot of God-given beauty. There was no question about that. But I also believe that she had something in her that other people found attractive in terms of her character, all right? The hidden person of the heart, all right? She probably had a lot of class in a lot of different ways. And but at the same token, I just feel like you look at her physical attributes, and that was God-given for a purpose. And I really believe that it's God-given to each and every one of us for a purpose, our physical attributes. I mean, if you read about Moses, for example, if you read about it in Exodus, and also he's mentioned in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the faith chapter, he mentioned how Moses was a beautiful baby. And his parents did not want to obey the Pharaoh's edict to have all the male children slain. So they hid the baby, but then when they couldn't hide him any longer, they said they put him in a basket and let him float downstream. And it says that Pharaoh's daughter saw him, and it says because he was such a beautiful baby, she took him up. I mean, if he had been an ugly baby, if he had been a retarded baby or something, they said, oh, he's just a Jewish kid, let him die. But, I mean, God made him a special-looking baby. People, when they saw him, they just saw that this kid is really beautiful, and that it really touched Pharaoh's daughter's heart. So I, you know, like I said, I don't want to get off on tangents, but I just can't help but just see so many different things that you can glean from the scriptures in terms of your own life, your own application. I mean, a lot of us feel like sometimes, I guess, feel like you may not be satisfied with your looks. But you got to understand something. Hey, God created you to look the way you are for a purpose, for a reason. Everything about you is for a purpose, for a reason. Everything, you know, all of your experiences in life is for a purpose and for a reason. And he's fashioning and shaping and molding us for his glory and for his honor. And it's saying here, telling her, look, if you don't step up to the plate, then God will find a different way to deliver us. But he basically said the ball's in your court and God put you there for a reason and you better do what you're supposed to do. And I think that's the same thing with all of us. God has a job for us to do. He's made it, created us for a purpose, for a reason. And if we don't do what we are supposed to do, in other words, God put us here to know him, love him, serve him with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And he's got a job for us to do. And if we slough off on our job, well, somebody's got to pick up the slack somewhere. And God will somehow get the job done through somebody else, all right? But we are definitely going to be held accountable before him for not doing what we were supposed to do. Anyway, beginning with that chapter 5, beginning with verse 1, it says, now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's room, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And it happened when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it will be given to you." And Esther said, "If it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet which I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther prepared. And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half my kingdom it shall be done." So Esther answered and said, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. And Haman controlled himself, however, and went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. And Haman also said, "Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." And Zeresh and his wife and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now here, the plot really begins to thicken, and I think it's really unique in many respects. But just backing up here, Esther, after fasting 3 days, 3 nights, not having anything to drink or eat, and obviously they're praying to God because this is a desperate, desperate situation. Now, you know, she puts on her royal clothes and she goes up to, she comes into the court of the king. The king's sitting on his throne and he sees her there. And under the laws and measures of Persia, anybody who approaches the king, his guards are to kill them right there on the spot, unless the king hands out or extends the scepter. And that scepter, it was just like a rod or a staff that was probably around 2 feet long. It usually had an ornament on the end of it. It was usually gold. Okay, if he extends his scepter, then that means that this person can approach him. All right, and then she came up and she touched the scepter. I think this is kind of significant too, because if you go back to the book of Genesis, I believe it's the 49th chapter, where Jacob is blessing his sons, and then he gives a prophecy about Judah. He says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes." And Shiloh was a cryptic name for the Messiah, meaning that the Messiah would come through the tribe of Judah. That the scepter, the ruling king, the ruling prince, the scepter would be in his hand. Interesting thing, too, is that, in a sense, we are all under this judgment and we cannot approach God under penalty of death unless he extends the scepter to us. And, of course, we touch the scepter. That, to me, has real symbolism to it, application to it. That we can't approach God. We can't even come into God's throne room under penalty of death. We cannot unless he extends his scepter. Well, through Jesus Christ, the scepter has been extended to us. Because, you know, like the Bible prophesied that Jacob said that the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. It was Jacob who made that prophecy. Okay, so she comes up and she touches the top of the scepter. Now, here's an interesting thing. When she does, you know, the king's delighted to see her. And I wonder, well, he hasn't seen her for 30 days. That's what she said. So they may have had a bit of a strain in their relationship a month ago. And he thought, well, I don't need, you know, I got plenty of women I could, you know, have fun with. He's got this huge harem to pick with. He says, I don't need to, you know, be around a crabby woman. So I don't know. I don't know what it was. But he, for a whole month, he hasn't seen this woman. And so she's, you know, she's really pretty scared. All right, but she steps out in faith through a lot of prayer. And we are told in Proverbs that the heart of the king is like water in the Lord's hands, where he can channel it anywhere he wants it to go. And so the king sees her. She looks absolutely stunning, absolutely gorgeous. He says, man, you know, come on in. So anyway, he basically promises her up to half his kingdom. And I think, of course, that was just an expression. He wasn't going to give her no blank check, but it just made it sound like that. So anyway, then what happens? He invites Haman and the king to come to a banquet on the following day. And this is all, I think, all in the Lord's timing. because the timing wasn't quite right. But the whole thing is being set up now, where Haman leaves, and Haman is delighted. But what happens? Haman sees Mordecai. Mordecai isn't trembling before him. Mordecai isn't bowing down, doing homage. Mordecai doesn't even get up to recognize him, because Mordecai can see right through this guy. This guy is a godless, worthless, wicked man, and he's not about to fear and tremble before him. And this just really infuriates Haman. It infuriates him. But interesting thing, he goes home, and then he starts recounting all of his blessings. He's got 10 sons, and that during those times, during this Persian monarchy, they were extremely valued. As a matter of fact, Herodias, the historian, had written something to the effect that the king every year would send a gift to whatever man in his kingdom had the most sons, because that was considered to be a symbol of great strength and great blessing. And so here Haman has 10 sons. Not only does he have 10 sons, but he's got all these riches, all this wealth. You know, he's got all these material things, and he's got all of this power at his fingertips. He's made it all the way up the line in terms of becoming basically prime minister of the Medes and the Persians. But then, in the midst of all this, what happens? You know, he's not satisfied. He's ticked off. He's frustrated. He's irritated because one man doesn't bow down and kiss his feet. And you know what? I mean, I read this and I say, you know what? Isn't this a lot like human nature in many respects? It's like, we got to look at what God has given us in life and look at our blessings that we have in life. And isn't it invariably that people who have such blessings will, you know, kind of hone in, focus on what it is they don't have or what it is that displeases them, rather than looking at what God has given them? I mean, this happens not just in the world. It happens in the church. And when people do that, they really, I think, unwittingly cultivate a spirit of ingratitude. When, if you look at all the things that God has given us in life, all right, and if all we can do is just be ticked off because of what we don't have, I think it really shows the smallness of character. And I really think that we as Christians, sometimes we really need to step back, and we really need to take a good, hard, cold look at how God has blessed us. I mean, I've often thought this, you know, because a lot of times we have the tendency, with our fallen nature and the world we live in and stuff like that, to always think, well, you know what, if I just had $1 million, if I just had unlimited funds, if I just had unlimited resources, I could be happy, or if I could buy this and get that and so on and so forth, I could really be fulfilled in life. And, I mean, if we stop and we take a good, hard, cold look at what we do have, and I think take inventory. Like, for example, I know I've said this in times past, but I just thought, what would you be willing to give up for $1 million? Would you be willing to give up your eyesight for $1 million? Would you be willing to give up your hearing for $1 million? Would you be willing to give up your legs or your arm for $1 million? I mean, what would you be willing to give up? I mean, I wouldn't give any of those things up, not one split second. I don't care if it's $1 billion. You couldn't give me $1 billion for my eyesight. No way. You know? So in a sense, we have been given so much that we just don't even consider half the time. I mean, there's hardly a day go by I don't thank God for my eyesight. I don't thank God for my health. I don't thank God for so many little things. I mean, I could rarely drink a glass of water without thanking Him with every swallow, because I just feel like, hey, this is what would life be without these ordinary things that we take so much for granted? And it's such a blessing, such an incredible grace and blessing that we've been given. And yet we focus in on what? It just shows that, hey, man, there's something wrong with us. There's something wrong with this Haman. I mean, if he was truly a man, it wouldn't have bothered him at all. He would have said, oh, Mordecai, hell with him. No, but he's got everything going for him, and he's just ticked off. He's just so aggravated, irritated. And I mentioned this last week when we were talking about this character, Haman. Haman, to me, he really epitomizes, he, you know, reflects, or is kind of a prefigurement of the state today. And what I mean by that is, I look at the state, and I'm talking about the government. And I look at the government as becoming more and more hateful towards God's people. That's why Haman, when he went to the king, he said, hey, there's a people out there, they don't adhere to our laws. These people have their own laws and their own customs and their own traditions, their own way of doing things. You know, so he wants them all killed. Look at the state today. And I'm talking about, when I talk about the state to me epitomizes political correctness. All right? The state says, hey, you can't mention God in school. You can't have the commandments hanging in your classroom. You can't read the Bible in school. You can't talk about God in school. You can't, you know what I'm saying? This is Haman. All right? And how does the state vilify us? It vilifies us by saying that we are right-wing extremists, that we are radical, that we are fanatical, that we are, you know, dangerous, that we are intolerant, that we, you know, the list goes on and on and on, doesn't it? Well, this is Haman when he looks at this Mordecai. So what does his wife and his friends say? Hey, man, don't let this good-for-nothing bug you. He said, build a gallows. Build it, 50 cubits high. 50 cubits high, a cubit is like 18 inches. So we're talking about a gallows that's 75 feet high. All right? And what I'm assuming is just two long vertical poles, and then they got one horizontal pole that goes across the top of it. So, you know, and the reason they want to make it so big is because they want everybody to see him hanging there, you know, swaying in the wind as an example to anybody who would dare, you know, defy Haman. And you want to make an example of him. And believe me, the state is trying to make examples out of people who take a stand for God. Believe me, there's no question about it. And it's going to get worse and worse. So anyway, in verse, let's just read this chapter 6, and then we're going to close for tonight. Because it says in verse 1, it says, during the night the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthania and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And the king says, what honor or dignity has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended to him said, nothing has been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And the king's servants said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, this shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short of anything of all that you have said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home mourning with his head covered. And Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now, here's a situation where it's almost comical when you look at it. I mean, you talk about things backfiring on you. I mean, here's the thing. We can see God's providence beginning to unfold. It's clear as a bell to me. Because Esther, she didn't reveal what was really on her heart that day. She said, come back tomorrow, and I'm going to prepare you a great meal, and then I will let you know my request. Well, that night, the king couldn't sleep. You look at various portions throughout the Bible, and you will see how God sometimes will do some of his greatest work with men when they're asleep on their bed, or when they can't sleep on the bed, you know, like what he did with Daniel, or did with Nebuchadnezzar, and did with other men throughout Scripture, how he will reveal his thoughts to them. Well, Here is Ahasuerus or Xerxes, and he can't sleep. He's tossing and turning, and thank God he didn't have TV in those days because he didn't know what to do to entertain himself. So he calls some of his servants in, and he says, go get the Book of Chronicles. So he figured, well, this ought to put me to sleep, I guess. I don't know. They're going to read some of the history of what's taking place in his kingdom. So they're just reading all these press clippings, I guess, and they recount that story of Mordecai. And we read it, I think, in the earlier chapters, where Mordecai had overheard a plot to kill the king by two of his eunuchs. And Mordecai informed Esther of this plot to kill the king, and Esther told the king, and they investigated it, they found out to be true, then they executed these two guys. And, you know, Mordecai was never given any credit, never thanked, never... he was just completely overlooked in that situation. And look at the timing. The timing was that he couldn't sleep, so that, you know, we look at this and say, wow, that's quite a coincidence. But it wasn't a coincidence. With God, there's no coincidence. God orchestrated this whole thing. And the king, it just dawned on him, hey, well, what's been done for this guy that has basically saved my life? And he said, well, nothing's been done for him. And then he says, well, who's in the court? And then just then, Haman starts walking in. He says, well, and then he asks Haman, he says, hey, what should we do for a guy we really want to honor? And he said, well, he's got to be me, you know. You've got to go on and honor me. And so he comes up with this elaborate thing, and he comes off right with the top of his head. So it kind of suggests to me the guy has probably thought about this before, you know, how he would like to be honored. He didn't say, well, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. No, it was on the top of his head. Well, go get a horse that the king has ridden before. Go get the royal clothes that the king has worn before. Go get the crown that the king has worn before. And he says, and then put it on this guy you want to honor, and then have one of your noble officials walk him around all throughout the city saying, this is how the king will honor somebody who is true to the king or he wants to honor. And, you know, talk about humiliation for this guy. The guy, he wants to go into the king and say, hey, I want this guy hung. You know, now he's parading him through here. This is, to me, it's what's going to happen in the very end. Because remember what Jesus said to the Church of Philadelphia in the book of Revelation, chapter 3, where he talked about how people that were basically considered themselves to be God's people and they really hated the true people of God. You know, and Jesus said something to the effect of them about that these people were really of the synagogue of Satan, and that God, Jesus would eventually reveal his true people, and that these other people who had hated the true Christians, all right, they would come down and bow down before them and acknowledge them to be the one that Christ had loved. All right, well, this is what we see today. We see we're kind of living in an Alice in Wonderland where everything is turned on its head, where good is called evil and evil is called good, where the righteous are called wicked and the wicked are called righteous. This is the world we live in, right? Well, this is all going to be turned on its head real soon when Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom. You know, the people who are in positions of power and fame and prestige and so on and so forth, most of those people, if not all of them, but I think the overwhelming majority of them, are going to find themselves on the bottom of the heap, all right? Because it's the people who are true to God who are always being under the thumb of the people who hate God. And the people who hate God are usually the ones who are in positions of power. There's no question about it. I mean, you just look around and you look at our cultural elite. You know, these are people who are in our media. They're in academia. You know, these are college professors. These are the people that are in the press. They're in our courts. They're in our judicial system. They're in our entertainment industry. They are epitomized by the ACLU, by lawyers and attorneys. I mean, these are the people that really are making the laws, and these are the people that very often are just diametrically opposed to God and the people of God. They want to just rid the world of their faith, of their beliefs, of their moral stands, of everything that they stand for. They want to stamp it out. They want to annihilate it. All right? Well, this is all going to be turned on its head, because in the end, God is going to elevate, all right, the very people that the world wants to destroy. That's why I see this Haman. And you talk about humiliation for this guy, everything's turned around on him. I mean, I would like to finish this, you know, go through more of this, but I think what we need to do is, there's no way I think we could read this chapter 7 and do it justice, because we have less than 10 minutes. So what I want to do is pick up where we left off next Thursday and finish this book up, because there's 10 chapters, but that last chapter is very, very short. You know, it's only like 3 or 4 verses. So We'll finish this up, God willing, the Lord willing, next week. Anybody have anyone to add or share this story?
You can see when God's timing is right, that everything just starts going one after another. I mean, it doesn't, this last verse, no sooner than he gets home in humiliation that he doesn't get a chance to even rest. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's over, man.
Look at the wife says in that verse 13, and his friends. These are the ones who kind of put him in this predicament to begin with, right?
Yeah.
All right? But look what they say now in verse 13. And Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, like I said, he's on his way down now. It's like he's falling off the roof, and it's just a matter of time before he splatters on the concrete. You know, he says, you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but that will surely fall before him. And the reason they've said this, I think, is because, you know, if you go back to the book of Samuel and you go back to other portions of Scripture, I think the Amalekites and, of course, other people could see that, hey, man, these are God's people, and you're not going to be able to stand before them. I mean, look what happened to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when Nebuchadnezzar threw him into the fiery furnace. God delivered him from that. Look what happened to Daniel when he under Darius, when he was thrown to the lions, and God delivered him from that. And it was the enemies of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Well, when I say the enemies, in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the strongest men in Nebuchadnezzar's army took him up to this fiery furnace to throw him in, and they were burned up. And then, you know, the very people who accused Daniel of being unfaithful to the king, you know, they and their family were the ones who were devoured by the lions. So they almost begin to say, hey man, this Mordecai, who, if he's a Jew, I think you've had it. So obviously he must really be distressed now, because the very people who supported him are now saying, hey man, you know, it's all over for you. So, and then he's rushed, like I said, then he's rushed off to this banquet, and his head must be barely spinning because he doesn't know what to do and how to act now. All right. And now, this is just the beginning of his fall, because next week we'll just read how it all backfires on him. But this is, to me, I think it's pretty instructive. I think it's pretty insightful, because I do think that you can see so much of what is going to happen in the end, where God is going to deliver his people, and the very people who wanted to destroy his people are the ones who are going to be destroyed themselves. Anybody have anyone to add or share?